This week on Making Contact.
She's pregnant, she's a woman, and she has the same needs that any other pregnant woman has.
It's important to have a space where they have books about dreadlocks, about Native women, about Black women, about lesbians. Because I know, okay, I'm represented here.
Women across the nation are struggling with access to quality reproductive health services. And the communities hit hardest are the ones who can least afford it. But solutions are coming as women's health issues continue to become more and more integrated into the overall social justice conversation. On this edition, we sit down with Evelyn Shen, a reproductive justice organizer, and we'll hear about some of the community-based work being done in San Francisco, Denver, and New Orleans. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information. Evelyn Shen joins me today in the studio. She's the Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. So, Evelyn, who is ACRJ?
ACRJ is a grassroots community-based organization here in Oakland, and we do community organizing and movement building, and we do it on the local, statewide, and national levels. And we work with community members and organizations who are interested in working for reproductive justice in their communities.
So, Evelyn, how does reproductive justice and reproductive rights differ?
Well, Tina, reproductive rights advocates tend to be single-issue focused, most notably on abortion, and they have a strong reliance on legislative advocacy. So they're often, you know, at the Capitol and the state, at D.C., passing policies and doing legislative advocacy. And they tend to have an individual rights framework, focusing on, you know, my individual right to choose. Reproductive justice is about having self-determination over our bodies, our sexuality, gender, and reproduction. So, for example, a person has reproductive justice when they have access to health care, if they are homeless or if they're an immigrant. A person has reproductive justice when they're able to walk down the street and not be sexually assaulted. A person has reproductive justice when they can drink the water and not be contaminated, or have, if they're pregnant, have their fetus be contaminated. And a person has reproductive justice when they're able to create families of their choosing and have children regardless of their gender or sexual orientation. So as you can see, reproductive justice is inherently connected to a wide range of social justice issues and is as much about the self-determination of an individual as the self-determination of the communities that these individuals belong to. Reproductive justice is about making change from the ground up. And so that means that each community or region will have different specificities in terms of what are the best strategies and ways to involve communities to make that change.
Well, that leads me then to this next segment. It's produced by correspondent Elena Botkin-Levy. It's a piece about women who are homeless and pregnant in San Francisco.
All right, we're going to go ahead and stretch out your legs.
On a Thursday morning in San Francisco, nine women stretch out on red and purple yoga mats in a large room. One of these women is Laura Cooper. She's 21 years old with a wide grin, and she's 5 months pregnant.
It's very tiring at the end. It makes you sweat. Move in
circles. But this yoga class is different from other pregnant yoga. It's part of a free wellness center for homeless women and women struggling with poverty.
You know, I've had a rough life. You know, I grew up with parents who were addicted to drugs. So I left them when I was 18 and came to live with an uncle who found out he was on drugs. So I just started living on the streets.
Laura is just one of at least 6,000 people who are homeless in San Francisco. National estimates say that more than 40% of the homeless population are women. And many of them, like Laura, have spent more than 5 months living on the streets.
I was sleeping on a beach for about 6 months in Santa Monica. It was horrible and raining and didn't have nowhere to go. I felt like crap, honestly. I couldn't take a shower every day. I couldn't brush my teeth.
Laura found some refuge in the local library. That's where she found out about San Francisco's Homeless Prenatal Program, or HPP. It's an organization offering a variety of services and resources to women who are pregnant or have children. I met with HPP's executive director, Martha Ryan, in their offices in San Francisco.
The Homeless Prenatal Program was started almost 20 years ago from volunteer work that I was doing. I was interested in pregnancy, and I had heard that there were women who were homeless that weren't getting prenatal care. And as a nurse practitioner, I knew that if a woman didn't get good prenatal care, that she would have an unhealthy baby.
one of the most unique aspects of HPP is that more than half of the staff are formerly homeless moms. One of these women is Antoinette Fort.
Well, I found out about homeless prenatal because I was a victim of domestic violence. I was having my second child, and I had to flee from her father.
In fact, Antoinette isn't alone. 90% of homeless women are said to have experienced severe physical or sexual assault. And more than 60% of these women have been victims of domestic violence by an intimate partner.
At the time, I was actually on parole. I think I had like about 3 years clean and sober. I was doing really good. I was 5 months pregnant, and he tried to kill me. If it wasn't for the neighbors upstairs hearing me, I could probably be dead today. Right after I had my baby, I had my papers come in the mail and said, congratulations, you just got Section 8, blah, blah, blah. And I went down there, and they denied me at first because I was on parole. And then once I got housed, I started looking for employment, and I said, what better place not to come back to than homeless prenatal?
Antoinette works at HPP now as a family case manager. After finding stable housing, she joined the Community Health Worker Program. It's a 12-month paid internship that trains formerly homeless mothers in basic job skills, client advocacy, and facilitation. As the face of HPP, they do intakes for all new clients and outreach on the streets of San Francisco.
So how you're due in January, you guys, so does that mean you're about 4 months? 2.5 to 3 months?
It's just after the Thursday morning yoga class. Laura and seven other pregnant women with different sized bellies sit with Nancy Frappier, the training and wellness center coordinator, to talk about how they're feeling in her prenatal class.
Okay, so you probably aren't feeling a whole lot yet.
HPP offers more than just basic services to women. In addition to yoga and prenatal classes, the Wellness Center also has massage and chiropractic work for clients.
Well, we offer these services really because to be healthy and to have a healthy baby, you need more than just medical support. You need support in all different aspects of your life.
That's Serena Saeed. She's the volunteer coordinator at the Wellness Center.
Yes, housing is really important, and we have groups here that work on housing. We have case managers that work on housing, but the Wellness Center is a place people can come to work on what's going on inside.
The National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty says about 3.5 million people will experience homelessness this year in the U.S. HPP's holistic approach to providing services challenges the way that many homeless people are perceived and treated.
People are pregnant and then they become homeless, or people are homeless and they become pregnant. But the question really isn't why is that happening? The question is how can we help? How can we help this woman to support her child, support herself, and get out of this situation of homelessness, but also realize that she's pregnant, she's a woman, and she has the same needs that any other pregnant woman has.
Laura's baby is due in November. She's off the streets now and living with her boyfriend and his mom. She's getting on lists for Section 8 housing, and she's back in school.
I got a 4.0 right now, so pretty excited about that. So I'm just trying to get everything. I'm taking 12 credits this semester, so I can get some kind of certificate. I'm taking hotel operations for the front desk, so maybe I can get a hotel job here in the city or something to help me support my family.
But it's a struggle. Rising rent and food costs, a lack of social services, drugs, welfare reform, systemic poverty, economic injustice. Women are systematically marginalized by these core issues. San Francisco's HPP offers unique services to women and families.
Have you heard the baby's heartbeat?
Yeah.
You see it.
But the problems are bigger than one organization.
The world's not going to change. I believe the world's not going to change just because of one person. It's going to take a lot more than one person to make a difference. We just have to come together as people who've been there and been in the struggle of being homeless, being pregnant, being alone, not having family support. It's hard to even live your life without having that support of family. It's just something that a teenager shouldn't have to go through.
For Making Contact, I'm Elena Botkin-Levy, San Francisco.
I'm here with Evelyn Shen, the Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. Evelyn, when people talk about reproductive rights, they often think about the right to an abortion. And although that's extremely important, it also seems like the basic right to bear a child is a key aspect of RJ work as well. Yeah, Tina, I think this is a critical point for many communities who are fighting for self-determination. This country has a history of regulating who can or cannot have children. Whether we're talking about forced sterilization among African Americans and Latinas, or the regulation of family formation of low-income families and women of color through welfare reform, or regressive immigration laws that work to restrict immigrants from having children, or school policies that kick teens out when they become pregnant. I think the right has successfully coined the term family values to move an agenda that aggressively works to keep certain communities from bearing children and having families.
Well, so what are some of the projects ACRJ is working on?
Well, one of the key campaigns this fall that we're working on is to educate voters about Proposition 4, the parental notification initiative that's happening for the third time in California, that will abolish confidential services for young people who are seeking abortion services. And if passed, this will create a climate that's really unsafe for our youth. Additionally, we have a nail salon worker project, which organizes nail salon workers to make changes to protect their health and safety in the workplace as part of the California Healthy Nail Salons Collaborative. And finally, we have a national movement building initiative called Emerge, which is designed to build a strong and vibrant reproductive justice movement. And it connects us with groups across the country, including the Women's Health and Justice Initiative in New Orleans, which is doing groundbreaking work in that community.
Well, I'm glad you said that. I actually visited the New Orleans Women's Health Clinic a few weeks ago. It's a project started by a group of fierce women in the South.
New Orleans Women's Health Clinic, how can I help you?
I'm sitting in the waiting room of the New Orleans Women's Health Clinic. It's located in the Treme area of New Orleans, just outside the French Quarter.
We're located between our Robertson and our Villering.
It's one of the oldest Black communities in the nation, known as much for its art and culture as its legacy of community activism.
Okay, thank you. You have a nice day. Bye-bye.
I'm waiting to see Monique, the clinic's sole family nurse practitioner. She sees between 20 to 50 patients, 2 days a week. Lenora is the office manager. She's a native New Orleanian, just like the other staff members.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Are you a new patient? Do you have an appointment?
The waiting area is small but welcoming. The walls have been recently painted canary yellow. Books like Undivided Rights and Our Bodies Ourselves line the clinic's one bookcase. The Feminist News Journal, Off Our Backs, and art books are strewn across the coffee table.
From a sliding fee scale, which is based on your income, so that'll be the way we'll determine how much your fee will be.
The clientele is mostly Black and Latina. Teens, 20-year-olds, women in their 40s are all waiting to be seen. The atmosphere is light, even a little fun and unpredictable.
Jesus on a main line, tell him what you want.
That's 20-something-year-old Shalanda, a new patient. She started to sing this song while she was sitting in the waiting room.
Jesus on a main line, tell him what you want. You just call him up and tell him what you want.
That's not something you expect to hear at a medical clinic, but this particular clinic is anything but ordinary.
Our community members who come to our clinic for services aren't just patients. They're women, they're mothers, they're queer, they're undocumented.
22-year-old Mandisa Moore describes herself as a radical Black dyke feminist. She's a member of the New Orleans Women's Health and Justice Initiative, a community-based collective. The initiative created the women's clinic with one purpose: to empower low-income women of color by giving them the means to control and care for their own bodies, sexuality, and reproduction.
It's important to have a space where I can get my healthcare needs, but at the same time, I can learn that, hey, I have yeast infection. I don't have to take that cream. I could use a tampon with yogurt. You know what I'm saying? Or like, oh, you know, there are ways of checking my own breasts or da-da-da-da. So that, like, that way, it's a blatant way of trying to counteract the medical industrial model, which teaches us that you need doctors, you need nurses, and you don't know anything about your body, and you must come to me and, like, and take every pill and take every medicine I give you because it's all you know, it's all you should know.
Before Hurricane Katrina, very few community hospitals existed, especially ones that catered to women who were uninsured. Dr. Joya Creer Perry is the clinic's medical director.
If you were pregnant, say you had no insurance and you were pregnant, the only way you can get into Charity Hospital for an appointment was through the emergency room. So you'd have to go to the emergency room and say, I missed my period, and wait for 12 hours for a pregnancy test. And then you get a little slip of paper that either allows you to go into the clinic for an appointment. You couldn't just call up and say, I'm pregnant, I want to get an appointment.
Besides that, Charity Hospital was located all the way downtown in Orleans Parish.
So if you had high blood pressure and you lived in the lower ninth ward and you had to take three buses to come just for your doctor's appointment.
After the storm, things got worse. Charity Hospital closed down. Although public officials vowed to create a better healthcare system, many said that was simply code for the desire to establish privately owned healthcare clinics. If that happens, that could leave tens of thousands of Louisiana's most vulnerable residents without healthcare.
No matter poor, uneducated, whatever, people want to be treated well, and they want to not have to go to the emergency room to get an appointment, and they want to be able to call and talk to you if they have a question, and they want prenatal classes, and they want, you know, all these things that are lacking.
That's what this particular clinic has been doing for more than a year now, providing basic OBGYN care. That includes pap smears and breast exams, free STD and HIV testing, prenatal counseling. They also offer abortion referrals. It's a place where you can come pick up a condom on your way out the door or talk to someone about birth control methods. But it's more than that.
It's important to have a space where people who don't speak English, who speak Spanish, can still come and get quality, affordable, accessible services. It's important to have a space where they have bottles of water for you, where it smells like black tea, where they have books about dreadlocks, about Native women, about black women, about lesbians. Because I know, okay, I'm represented here.
You ready?
Even after a long day's work, Monique is still bright-eyed and full of energy.
There are two exam rooms, one right next to each other.
She shows me around the clinic. It's a small space, and every inch is put to use. Monique tells me she loves her work, and it's obvious.
We do a number of first-time exams, or we do exams for women who've had negative experiences with PAPs. So what we have is some of the volunteers of the clinic have come up with these cute little sayings or these jokes that we've taped to the ceiling. So one example is, what goes up but never comes down? And of course the answer is age. So a lot of people will sit there like, what goes up and never comes down? Wow. By the time they finish reading a couple of the jokes, I'm already done with the exam.
So you're fast.
Yes.
It's behind the doors of a simple storefront with a parking lot for a view. You could easily miss this unique clinic as you walk down Esplanade, but many grateful women in this community don't. They come to a place that provides quality health care, understanding, and a sense of belonging.
I don't know where our patients would have been if we didn't exist. I don't know where they would go. I really don't. So, you know, we provided a gap when no one was there. And it's just now that a few other providers are starting to pop up, we're still here. And so people still trust us and they still come here. And, you know, if these women hadn't gotten together and said, we might not know much about healthcare, we don't know anything about opening up a clinic, but we're just going to paint some walls and let them come, I don't know what would have happened. I really don't. Yeah.
Evelyn Chen with Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. One of the things that was interesting in talking with folks in New Orleans is that the organizing strategies seem different. Is organizing for reproductive justice different around the country, in particular in the South?
So in the South, organizing for reproductive justice is fairly new, but what we are finding is that groups in the South, like the Women's Health and Justice Initiative, like Insight, Sister Song, or Spark Reproductive Justice Now, all describe the need for specific strategies to address the historical lack of investment in Southern communities. And we're finding that reproductive justice organizing varies from region to region. So we have groups in states like Idaho or Utah who are having to negotiate traveling miles and hundreds of miles between one house to another to do a rural organizing around reproductive justice. Indigenous groups like Los Angeles Indigenous Peoples Alliance and the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center use models of addressing reproductive justice by making sure that they are addressing issues of sovereignty and leveraging the cultural strengths of their communities. So regional organizing is important, and the beauty of reproductive justice is that it understands the necessity of building new organizing models that may look very different from region to region and from community to community.
I'm here with Evelyn Shen, the Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice, based here in Oakland, California. We'll be right back. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcasts at radioproject.org. I'm sitting in the studio with Evelyn Shen, Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. So Evelyn, how do young women fit into the reproductive justice movement?
Young women are critical to the reproductive justice movement. They bring the necessary leadership, creativity, and innovation that fuels the reproductive justice movement. We can't talk about building a strong and vibrant movement without involving the next generation. Additionally, their leadership and involvement is critical because they are often the most under-resourced groups in our communities and face critical challenges to their reproductive health that can have huge implications for their ability to thrive.
Well, I think this next piece, produced by Denver correspondent Grace Hood, demonstrates some of the points you just mentioned.
Lower pleasure.
Okay. Here's your cracker. Say thank you.
Felicia Barjas just turned 20. She's not old enough to drink, but she is old enough to care for her 2.5-year-old daughter, Zoe. Compared to many teen moms, Felicia is lucky. She has a supportive family and partner, Carlos. And that stability has helped her stay on track.
I had to do 10th grade over again because when I found out I was pregnant, it was at the end of 10th grade and I didn't finish school. So I had to start all over, and a lot of people didn't think I was going to do it because they're just like, she's going to give up, it's going to be too hard for her. But I did it. I graduated. I just graduated in May, so that was exciting.
Felicia's story isn't new. In fact, statistics show that more than 750,000 teens become pregnant each year in the U.S. In Denver, teen pregnancy is alarmingly high, especially for Latinas. An overwhelming 80% of babies born to girls 15 to 17 have Latina moms. That's according to the Colorado Department of Public Health and Education. Even though Felicia finished high school, it's not the norm. Parenthood is said to be the main reason kids drop out of school. Less than a third of these teens will ever go back.
We know that there are certain barriers to accessing reproductive and family planning services, well, for teens in general, but particularly for Latina Hispanic students, whether it be that they're undocumented, whether it be that their primary language is not English. So again, really facilitating greater access to the information and the services that will help teens make well-informed decisions regarding their sexual health.
That's Jocelyn Martinez. She's the program director for the Denver Teen Pregnancy Prevention Partnership. The Prevention Partnership coordinates after-school programs, parent engagement workshops, and classroom presentations at three area schools. Eighth and ninth graders are the focus, a key demographic in the fight against teen pregnancy.
There's a lot more freedom for these students, as well as a lot more pressures in terms of experimenting with sexual activity. So we feel that working with these two grade levels is really critical to our intervention.
But bringing change isn't easy. Celine Garcia is program manager for parent engagement workshops. She says sex is a difficult topic for most families, but for Latino ones, it can be particularly difficult.
Many of them are from Mexico, and they are like, we are coming from this small village, and I expected everything except this. I expected you to get married and to have children, you know, the traditional society.
School's out, and I'm sitting in a local Denver restaurant with about 25 teen girls and their parents. We're celebrating the first year of Latinas of Vision, an after-school program of the Pregnancy Prevention Partnership. It's sponsored by the Colorado Organization for Latina Opportunity and Reproductive Rights, or CALOR, a nonprofit that is successfully creating more social and economic opportunities for Latinas. JC Montoya, Executive Director of CALOR.
For us, to have the girls engage in activism, to see that they have the opportunity to go to college, to get jobs in the community, really is a way to prevent teen pregnancy, because they have a reason to protect themselves, to delay initiation of sex, but also to use birth control and condoms.
The year was a successful one for many of these young activists. They spoke at a school board hearing about distributing condoms in Denver schools. These young women even made a documentary. Diana Maya is a ninth grader at Lincoln High School.
My favorite project would probably be the movie that we were working on earlier. It was about just the life of Lincoln students that struggle, like with not having papers or being pregnant or things like that.
Diana's here with her mom, Diana. They're celebrating Diane's participation in the group. That's partly because Diana was a teen mom.
I want them to have the correct information. And I've always been like, if they ask me a question, I'm straightforward with them. I'm not hiding anything from them, and they know exactly what it is. And I just don't want them to end up the same way and make the same mistakes, because it's very hard.
After dinner, the program directors hand out certificates and gifts to the teen girls. It's not hard to see hope, purpose, and a future for these young women. Ninth grader Diana Maya addresses the crowd.
I just want to thank everybody from Color and, well, everybody here, because all of you is awesome, and it got me involved in the community and politics, and I now consider myself an activist.
Come on, Zoe, we're home.
Being a mom is never easy, but being a teen mom has forced Felicia to grow up fast. She plans to start college this fall and wants to become a certified nursing assistant. Working her way through college means that the hardest years with Zoe are ahead, not behind.
I think it's getting more challenging as far as her getting older. You know, I just don't want her to grow up too fast. And then with me wanting to advance in my career, I think that's going to be going back to school. So it's going to be like starting all over again. But it's worth it in the end. Zoe, it's okay.
For Making Contact, I'm Grace Hood in Denver, Colorado.
Just from these three examples, there is such amazing RJ work being done around the country.
You know, it's really exciting. It's a really wonderful time right now. The reproductive justice movement is expanding. We're connecting with groups across the country who are doing very innovative work at the grassroots level and who are successfully mobilizing young people, communities of color, low-income communities, LGBTQ communities, folks with disabilities, and it's all around reproductive justice and social change. And I think the three stories that you highlighted really illustrate how people around the country are working on a number of fronts using service provision, advocacy, and organizing in really effective ways to engage communities and build leadership from the ground up. It is really a great time to join the reproductive justice movement.
Well, Evelyn Shen, Executive Director of Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice, thank you so much for joining us today in our studio.
Thank you, Tina.
And just to let our listeners know, in the next few months, we'll have another show talking about the intersections of RJ and immigrant rights. That's it for this edition of Making Contact. This program was partially funded by the Reproductive Justice Fund at the Tides Foundation. To hear full interviews with women from the show, visit our website at radioproject.org. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast on our website as well. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy, RJ coordinator, and Aubrey Green, intern. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.